Like to welcome everyone back to the ninth class in Sefer HaChinuch, in the 613 mitzvot, the study of the mitzvot and the meanings in our lives. Today we'll be covering four mitzvot from 17 to 20. So let's get started. The 17th mitzvah, Shelo Yochal Aral Min HaPesach, that we are not allowed to, for a person who is Arel, meaning a person who is not circumcised. Now we are though talking here about a Jew. If you recall, there was another separate mitzvah that specifically applied to somebody who was not Jewish, and the fact that he would not be allowed to partake of the Pesach, meaning of the Korban, of the sacrifice. So this specifically applies to a Jew who is not circumcised. Anyone who is not circumcised shall not eat of it. Now, when do we have such a situation where a person who is Jewish would not be circumcised? Such a circumstance can arise when, if a person had siblings who previously had passed away as a result of a brit milah. If God forbid a child had hemophilia or something along those lines, particularly in the times when they didn't necessarily have means to combat such a situation, and the Brit Milah, God forbid, could have caused the child to bleed to death or something along those lines, meaning the Brit Milah had been a cause to the child's death. In such situations, then the risk of future children is, of course, not put on the line, and therefore they're not given a Brit Milah. In these situations, meaning somebody who is like that, they would not be able to participate and eat from the Korban Pesach. Now, of course, someone else, though, who specifically decides that he does not want a Brit Milah, for example, the parents of the child did not give the child a Brit Milah, and that child, even upon his growing old, decides not to have it done to himself, or a situation where a person cosmetically restructures the orla, the foreskin, in order to remove from himself the fact that he had a brit milah, something along those lines. So such people, without any question, of course, are certainly included in this, and therefore not able to participate. So now, the situation here, though, is specifically though talking about the eating of the Pesach offering itself. He still can nevertheless participate in the Seder. He can definitely participate along the lines of eating for the matzah and the maror. And this extends to other members of the extended family of the Jews who may not necessarily be Jewish. And those people also, meaning those people who are living in Eretz Yisrael under various treaties and so forth, they would be able to participate at a Seder, but they would not be able to actually eat from the Pesach offering. Mishur, we talked about that specifically, meaning the non-Jew in relationship to this in a previous class. And for those interested, I would recommend looking at the website, www.teachittome.com, and downloading the previous class on that. Mishur Shem Mitzvazol, the underpinnings of this Mitzvah, Mashakatal Nubatol Shabbos Achir, you'll find there in that class as well. So at that place, you'll find it. Dini ha-mitzvah, the various laws connected to this mitzvah, kigom milat banav avadav im ma'akvinoto lishchot v'lechol mepesach. Various laws connected, for example, if whether or not his sons or his slaves, that whether or not their lack of a circumcision would allow them to be able to do the shechita, the actual preparation, or to eat from the Pesach offering. V'yeter pratei and various other details, more pesachim, you'll find that in Gemara Pesachim. V'noge v'zman habayit, this applies in the times of the Beit HaMikdash. And a person who violates this, meaning a person who is uncircumcised and he eats, he would receive malkut, he would receive lashes, since here there is an action involved in the actual eating itself, and it is a lav, meaning a negative commandment, therefore he would receive malkut, he would receive lashes. And again, that's also what we've talked about in previous classes. We whipped through this quickly, there isn't too much on it. Now, look, God willing, let's begin the next mitzvah. Mitzvat Kiddush Bechorot Be'eretz Yisrael. This is the 18th mitzvah, and it is concerning the sanctifying the firstborn in Eretz Yisrael. I mean, the actual mitzvah from the Torah is that a firstborn, has a certain status, and there needs to be that, again, if it's a firstborn of a kosher animal, the animal is sacrificed and so forth, brought to the Kohen, and then parts of it are sacrificed, possibly by the Kohen, and so forth and so on. Let's get to the details. L'kadesh ha-be'achorot, to sanctify the firstborn. Klomar shu'kol ha-veladot anoladim be'arishona. That means that every one of the firstborns, that those are the ones to be sanctified. Klomar yotze rishon rechem enekeva. Now, this specifically, though, occurs when it is the first one to exit the womb in the natural canal that the children will come from. Meaning that if it was a C-section or something else along those lines, meaning if it was extracted, the child, from the body of the mother, and it was done so in a non-natural fashion, then in those particular cases it would not apply here. So we're talking about specifically the firstborn that comes through the birth canal. That also eliminates situations where, if there was, God forbid, situations where there were miscarriages or things along those lines, that would go ahead and that would invalidate the future children from being considered firstborn, because again, the firstborn that we're talking about here is specifically those that are born the first out of, again, the womb through the natural birth canal. Ben Adam, now this applies whether or not it is a man, Ben Bebehem HaZecharim, or whether or not we're talking about the firstborn animals, which are man. And this, of course, applies when we're talking about here Bechor, though, we are talking here, as like I said, is the by man or by a male animal. Kodesh Lashem, these are considered holy. Shneemar, Kadesh li kol Bechor, Peter kol rechem in Israel, you shall sanctify for me every firstborn, the first issue of the womb amongst the Jews, b'adam u'behema lihu, whether it be from man or from animal, to me it is. B'dafka behema. Now this dafka, this specifically only applies to a animal which is domesticated, and that doesn't mean to say a wild animal is domesticated. There's certain animals that apply under this category. The haino, for example, shor v'keves v'ez. So, for example, this would be a cow or a lamb or a goat, and similarly, these animals are considered to have a special status, what's called a bema. There's another division of animals that's called a chaya. A chaya meaning, very often translated again, as wild animals, but these are non-domesticated animals. These include things like deer, antelope, and so forth and so on. And those animals don't apply for this. Now, there is one exception, in that all the animals we're talking about here that apply are kosher animals that are domesticated. There is one non-kosher animal where we have an additional mitzvah specifically applying to the firstborn, and that is on a donkey. So a firstborn donkey would have the same halakha, the same situation. Well, there are some slight differences, but would also need to be sanctified, or in this case redeemed, or when we get to the mitzvah, we will understand that it's either redeemed or there's a certain way that the animal would actually be killed. V'inyan ha-mitzvah b'mei ha-torah ken. Now this is the way the mitzvah applies to a kosher animal. Shemitzvah ala be'alim lahaktishov lomar harei ze kodesh. So first of all, when the firstborn animal is born, so the owner of the animal would then go to that animal and say, okay, this animal is now sanctified. So there is a verbal declaration that applies. Now he has to take this firstborn and he has to give it to a Kohen. And then the Kohen would then take this animal and he would sacrifice its chelev, which is a certain types of fats that are inside the animal, and his blood, they would be offered on the mizbeach, on the altar. And then they would eat the flesh of this animal in Yerushalayim. Now the animal isn't immediately given to the Kohen, but rather the owners would actually take care of the animal for the first 30 days, if it's one of these smaller breeds of animal, for example, like a goat or a sheep or something along those lines. And in the case of a larger animal, such as a cow, in those situations, the cow would after 50 days of taking care of it, they then would actually go ahead and offer it. And as I said, this is different in the sense where, again, the donkey doesn't apply in terms of all this, and the details will specifically come up later on when we're dealing with the actual form of redeeming for a donkey. Now, in the outside of Eretz Yisrael, where in this situation as we exist now, there's no Bet HaMikdash and so forth, and again, being in the diaspora, we are not able to perform this mitzvah. Nevertheless, there is a still an obligation that exists even when the Bet HaMikdash is not here. So what is done then? So Noah Dele Befanav Umet Me'alav Ladat Tzad Meforshim. So some of the rabbis explain that the way to deal with the situation is, since we are not able to take care of the animal to actually be able to offer it, is it actually then would be locked into a room, and it will be allowed to die on its own. And in this way, a person is not going to cause its death directly, which would be a halachic problem, but rather that the animal on its own would end up expiring. Umhem shamru shumam tin lo leolam. And there are others that explain that no, this is not the way this is dealt with, but rather the animal is cared for until the animal would eventually pass away. In other words, nothing can be done to the animal to cause it any problems, and again, the animal will just be left in that state until eventually it would, as we'll see later on, it might hurt itself or something along those lines, and therefore no longer be fit for a sacrifice, and that takes it out of this category, or the animal would die, and in that situation again, so therefore your obligations would disappear. So now, if on the other hand though, the animal that does obtain a mum, it obtains some sort of blemish that would invalidate it for sacrifice. So in all places and situations, anybody could eat it anywhere. I mean, you don't have to bring it to Eretz Yisrael, you don't have to bring it to Yerushalayim, where it would then be sacrificed and then eaten, the meat there in Yerushalayim, but rather any place that a person is located, and by any person, meaning a Kohen or Yisrael, any of those people are able then to be able to partake of this, and the Kohen basically gives the animal to whoever he wishes. Ukehulin hu nechshav. So it's considered to be just like a non-holy animal, and therefore anybody can eat of it, and there's no special rules. In the times of the Beit HaMikdash, when you had sanctified meats, there were very specific rules as to the spiritual status of the person, meaning in terms of his going to the mikvah and various other rules in order for him to be able to partake. So here again, none of this would apply. Kmo shekatuv, atame v'atahor yochlenu katzvi v'kayo. As it says that the tamei and the tahor, they shall eat it like the deer and like the ayil. V'chein ketav Ramban zal b'hilchot b'chor shelo, and also you'll find this spot down in the Ramban along the same lines in terms of his laws of the firstborns. V'chor adam. Now, when it comes to a firstborn man, the laws are also different. U'peter chamor nifrash in yanam, and the same thing, of course, regarding, as we said before, the firstborn of the donkey. All those will be explained in their specific mitzvah regarding how the redeemed shebekol echad ve'ezat Hashem, each one, God willing, according to his place. Behem b'sedezeh, there are those in the seder b'seder v'yikach korach, and there are those explained in the seder v'yikach korach. So mishor shem mitzvah. Now the underpinnings, the logical reasonings that become the basis for us to understand and grasp this mitzvah. Shiratza Hashem lezachotenu lasod mitzvah bereshit piryo leman dat ki hakol shelo, is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God, wanted to merit us that we should perform a mitzvah with the first fruits in order that we should understand that everything belongs to God. And that we should understand that nothing that exists in the world, which we happen to take possession of, is not something which has been graced to us by God. Now we can understand this in the following way. Ki achashi yagah hadam kama yigiyot v'tarach kama terachim balamo. Now a person goes ahead and he applies a lot of his energies in order to be able to achieve and in order to be able to have success, and he applies all this effort in this world. Now all of a sudden comes about the time where there's some sort of success from everything, and there's the fruit of his labors. And of course the first results of his efforts, they are considered to be for him the most beloved, because that's the first things that again come out from all of this. So everything he put in all the effort, finally something comes from it. Miyad notno laKadosh Baruch Hu, right away he gives it to God. Umitroken reshuto mimenu umachnisol reshut baro, he goes ahead and he takes it out of his possession and he puts it into the possession of God. Maybe by taking this animal, he's gone ahead and he's fed the parents, he's given them food, he raised them, he put all this effort into trying build up and create a farm. In other words, in order to be able to increase on his wealth, and all of a sudden, boom, he's got to take from that and give that to God. This is perhaps one of the most fundamental ideas that we need to internalize in our everyday lives. It's often particularly difficult for us here in this world to recognize and realize God's part. Specifically because of the fact that we're cursed to actually have to be constantly involved in raising and making a living, as opposed to being able to be involved exclusively in the divine plan of learning Torah and doing mitzvot. Now, the actual performance of the work one needs to be able to sustain his family, it is in itself, without any question, also a mitzvah, also something which he's commanded, meaning to take care of that which is under his reshut, under his obligations and responsibility. There's no question about that. But again, he says it can't be involved in the very holy and lofty, specific ideas of learning Torah, and specifically teaching Torah and so forth and so on. So this is, again, he has to be involved in the workplace. Now, being in the workplace, what happens? Day in and day out, he is going to be involved in specific labors. Those labors seem to have a direct fruit from everything which he has. And that in itself is a tremendous fallacy. We can never fall upon this trap to believe that our efforts are in fact what produce our results. Meaning that everything comes from God. And you have to have a certain amount of bitachon, a certain amount of trust in God that that's the case. Nevertheless, there is though a balance between hishtadlut, effort, and bitachon, and trust. A person cannot expect that if he doesn't make any effort, that he's in fact then in the end going to eat. As if a person doesn't work during the week, he cannot expect to eat on Shabbat. He cannot expect to eat at the end of the week. He's not going to have food. He's not going to have product. So therefore, there is a balance between the two. And it's an important balance for us to focus in on. How do you know when you've done too little? And how do you know when enough is enough? So sort of a concept called the minimum hishtadlut, the minimal effort that a person needs to make in order to be able to achieve. That means to say that you take a look and you see, what is it that a person needs to do to earn a living? So arguably, you'd say that's a 40-hour week. Okay, granted, let's say that's the case. If it would be normally, if, in other words, if the world or at large considers it normal that 40 hours is the amount of time a person goes to work, that means to say that you need to make those efforts, meaning that you need to go ahead, you need to go to work, and you have to do what you have to do. And not only that, you have to do a good job. If you don't do a good job at work, you can't expect to keep your job, and so forth and so on. Meaning you have to do what is necessary. But for a person to work a 90-hour week, an 80-hour week, for a person to go above and beyond, that's a problem. A person has obligations to his family, he has obligations to God, he has obligations to himself. And those obligations supersede trying to become rich, trying to extend beyond the boundaries of what we need to provide. And therefore, a person has to have a level of trust in God that if he's going to make the appropriate effort, he's going to get the appropriate returns. The effort has to be real. The effort has to be solid. But once he's making that, he has to turn around and say, whatever happens, happens. This is God's will. If I'm rich, if I'm poor, that's all from God's hand. Now, if a person wants to be able to encroach upon this effort that he's making and reduce it, I'll also argue that that's possible, but has to be done in a fashion where a person is looking to supplement, meaning he's looking to reduce from his work in order to be able to serve God. Meaning that if a person was to steadily work in his life to be able to increase the amount of Torah study that he can apply on a daily basis, that if that person was every day to go ahead and to fully use the full amount of time that he is allowed beyond his normal hishtadlut for parnasa, the normal amount that he needs in order to be able to succeed in terms of his work, if he goes ahead and he applies all that time, he says, then a person can pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God help me. And he can try to encroach and try to reduce the amount of hours that he applies to other things in order to be able to take that for the sake of Torah. I've seen it in my own life, and I've seen it in many other people's lives, that if a person makes that true and sincere effort, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will match him. Meaning that things will work out in order to be able to accomplish more in Kedusha, more in holiness, if a person truly dedicates the time that he does have for that purpose. And most importantly in everything, whatever in fact he does have, that he recognizes that this comes from God, and it's not from the efforts of his hands. ועוד לזכור הנס הגדול שעשה לנו השם בבחורי מצרים שרגם וצילם מידם. There's a further reason, and this reason actually is specifically mentioned in the Torah itself, as to why we have to sanctify the firstborn. And that is in order so that we remember the great miracles that were done for us in Egypt, and specifically how Sparhu had taken the life away from the firstborn of the Egyptians. And he saved us from this situation. Meaning that our firstborns were protected, while not only the firstborn male of every, and some people say the females as well, of every Egyptian died, but even the paintings, as they were into ancestral worship, even the paintings of the firstborns were destroyed, and that the animals firstborn, and so forth and so on, meaning that every firstborn in Egypt was destroyed, with the Jewish people not being touched. And ultimately speaking, this being the final makkah, the final strike, before the Jewish people then had left Egypt. Dinei ha-mitzvah, the various laws that are connected with this mitzvah, be'ezem makom nishchat v'nechal, where it can be slaughtered and eaten, ad eze zman mitzvah lahem lo'ochlo, until when can a person eat them, ve'inyan ha-mumin ha-boslimbo, and the various different blemishes that apply to the animal that make it no longer usable for this mitzvah, v'achiluk shminehem, the various differences between them and so forth. Mi ereman al-mumav, who is reliable to be able to determine what in fact is a blemish and so forth. Im naflu bo, how they occur to the person, nasu lo b'dat, or if they would, God forbid, be caused. If a mum happens, it's one thing, but it's another thing where a person intentionally was to cause the animal to have damage to it, and in that way make it pasul, make it not fit for the mizbeach. Ve'ezeh chacham roi lorot mumav, which rabbanim are capable of making these decisions. Ve'din b'chor ha-shutafim yisraelim or shutaf goy. Also the various laws concerning a firstborn who belongs to a Jew or is in partnership with a non-Jew. Ve'ezeh inyan niftara be'ma min b'chora o lo niftara. Or in which situations when a person is going to not be obligated based on the situations we talked about, such as if there were previous births, if there were previous miscarriages and so forth. Uvechor safek madino. Also, if there's a safek, if there's a question as to the situation. Binyan yotzidofen, if it's a cesarean birth. Tumtum, if there's a question of the actual gender of the child. whether in this case the child, the animal, doesn't have any sort of organs to indicate which way it goes, andrignos, or if it's a hermaphrodite. All those are actually found in Masechet Bechorot. There's an entire Masechet regarding, meaning a section of Talmud which deals with firstborn. Now, it only applies from the Torah itself in Eretz Yisrael, and it applies at all times when we're dealing with with the firstborn of the of a behemoth Torah, of a kosher animal. So this is, you shall eat before the Lord your God the tithe of your grain, your wine, your olive, and the firstlings of your herd and flock, and so forth and so on. Umidrabban af bechutz la'aretz ubezacharim yechavot, and this applies in a derabbanan, meaning it's from the rabbi's rules, even in outside of Israel, and whether it's male or female, ben Yisraelim, ben Kohanim Levim, whether or not it is owned by a Jew, or by a Kohen, or by Levi. Now, even though the laws regarding a firstborn, in other words, the Kohen is the one that receives the firstborn, so therefore, the Kohen who has an animal, now has a firstborn, the animal actually belongs to him. Nevertheless, though, he still has this obligation to sacrifice part of the animal, meaning its fats and its blood and so forth, and to eat the flesh, regarding the same laws of a Bechor, of a firstborn, that were specified for everybody. Regarding a person now, people that are firstborn, the firstborn of a man or the firstborn of the donkey does not apply to a Kohen or Levi. In those cases, they would not apply, meaning only if it's a Yisrael, only if it's a Jew, who then has either has a child himself or again, his donkey has a child, then it applies. Now, this is one of the mitzvot that we find in the Torah, which was given because of some reason. There was a specific reason given in the Torah, as it mentions that it says for all the firstborn among the Israelites, both of men and of beasts, they're mine. On that day I struck down every firstborn in the land of Egypt, consecrating them to me. And therefore, along those same lines, we remember this mitzvah, we remember this nes, this miracle that occurred, in specifically in our actually performing of this mitzvah. The 19th mitzvah, shelo le'chol chametz b'pesach, that a person should not eat chametz on Pesach. Shelo le'chol chametz b'shnema ve'lo yachel chametz, it says thou shalt not eat chametz, you shall not eat leaven. Mishorshei mitzvah zo, the underpinnings of this mitzvah, mashakatavnu b'shar mitzvah, the Pesach, it applies to everything else that we saw, and we had a number of long discussions in the past regarding the various understandings of chametz and terms of its meaning to us. The fact that the Arizal talks about the connection to cleaning out our houses from chametz, from having any leaven, and this is directly connected to the idea of cleaning out from ourselves any sin, and that the Arizal tells us that if a person is careful to make sure that in his home there is no chametz, then he is assured that that year he will not sin. So the various laws that are connected, and for example, where does chametz apply? Where does leavening apply? It applies when you have a case of one of the five different grains, meaning wheat, spelt, rye, oats, or barley, and one of those comes in contact with water, and after 18 minutes of coming into contact with water, they become chametz. They begin to ferment, and that fermenting process creates a mixture which is called chametz, which is called leavened. V'din halash otan b'meperot. There is other laws connected with this. If, for example, a person was to mix it not with water but with fruit juices. Now the case is that fruit juices, they do not create the same form of leavening action to happen. I mean, they don't react with the grains in the appropriate way to then be able to trigger a response from the east and so forth, and as a result, the laws of 18 minutes don't apply. That's why, for example, a person may find there's other types of matzahs on the market that are called matzah shira. They're called rich matzah, and the reason they're called rich is because in addition or in place of water, and most of the time we're talking about in place of water, for example, I saw now that there's matzahs that are made with grape juice, matzahs made with various other different types of juices and so forth, that these matzahs don't have a mixture of flour and water, but flour and juice, and as a result of that mixture, we say that it does not produce a leavening action. And as since there's no leavening action, the 18-minute rule we just said before doesn't apply. V'din l'tita, also regarding moistening the grains, that again, what point do we say that the grains have now reached a saturation and therefore come under a question of chametz? V'tavshu shenimsa bo chametz b'chamin u'b'tzonen, and also regarding both cold or hot foods that come into contact with chametz, I mean you find in them this mixture. V'yeta prateim v'vorim v'sachim, and various other details there explaining the Gemara Pesachim, and like I said, we've covered a number of them before. It applies to at all times to both men and to women. Now, if a person was to on purpose partake of chametz, meaning of this water and grain mix, and he did this on Pesach, he did it with intention and spite, then he ends up being chayv karet. He ends up being cut off spiritually from the heavens. If you take a look at the classes on the Sharei Kedusha, we discussed, which is also available there on the website, we discussed at length some of the concepts of karet and what that means. There's a general disagreement between the Rambam and the Ramban. The Rambam talking about a shortening of one's life, and the Ramban explaining that this is a cutting off spiritually between one's spiritual source and himself. And B'shogeg chayv chatat kavua, if a person was to have eaten the chametz for one of two reasons: either he didn't realize it was Pesach, or he didn't realize that what's in front of him, meaning, is in fact chametz. So in that situation, he doesn't understand, he didn't know that flour and water makes chametz, and he went ahead and ate of it, or he didn't realize it's Pesach. In that case, he would actually have to then bring a korban, he would bring a sacrifice in the Beit HaMikdash. So the 20th mitzvah, Shlo yirei lanu chametz v'Pesach, that it shall not be seen amongst us any chametz on Pesach. Now, if you were calling back to mitzvah number 11, we talked there about possession, and we did get into a number of details. So again, we'll also sort of fly through this. Shlo yirei chametz b'chol moshvotenu kol shivat yimei Pesach, that it should not be seen in any of our dwelling places for the 7 days of Pesach any chametz. Shneimar v'lo yirei lecha chametz. Shall not be seen to you chametz, v'lo yirei lecha se'or, and you shall not, it shall not be seen to you any se'or. Now, chametz is a resulting mixture, meaning a mixture that is leavened, where se'or is a starter dough, meaning it's something which is used in order to cause other doughs to then become chametz. That's the equivalent of like a yeast mash or something like that that a person would then be using in order to make bread and so forth. Behold, hu lecha shivat yamim, within all of your borders 7 days, this shall not be found. Ve'en ele shnei la'avim b'shnei inyanim aval hem b'inyan echad. Now, these two things, meaning chametz and se'or, meaning leaven itself or leavening agent, these two things are not two separate mitzvot, but rather they are together one mitzvah. Moshe Amuzal, like the rabbis have taught us, Patachak tu b'chametz v'siyem b'sor. The Torah begins with chametz, it begins with leavening, and it ends with leavening agents. Lomar lecha hu chametz hu se'or. That chametz and se'or, the two of them are the same. Meaning, whether or not you are the, in other, whether or not it is chametz, whether or not it is something leaven, or something which causes leavening, they're still considered to be just as bad. That's to say that it makes no difference between, again, this leavening or the causer of leaven. Now, if you go back to the various discussions that we had regarding chametz and its connections with sin, so what we understand from this is the idea that it doesn't make a difference whether or not a person is an instigator of sin or a person is the sinner himself. If a person is to go ahead and cause people to sin, even if he himself is not the one that sins, he is in fact a sinner. Even if a person is a partner in the situation, and he says, what's the big deal? What am I doing? What's the difference? If you are contributing something to the pot, if you're making it possible for all this to happen, you also are guilty. For example, a person might say, well, you know what? I don't copy software. I don't go out and I don't steal software. You know, I don't go to my friends, oh, give me a copy of this, give me a copy of that, give me a copy of this. But if people want to copy from me, it's their business. If they want to go ahead and they want to copy my CDs and so forth and so on, okay, it's their business. I'm not going to steal. But the idea is that if you made it possible for all this to happen, you also are part of the problem. The same thing applies to everything else. A person has to realize that it's not just what he does that matters, but what he causes other people to do. One of the best examples of that has to do with the question that comes up. Do you find it? I mean, almost without question, given any group of teenagers, and I'm talking even religious teenagers, right away the question is going to come up. Why is it that boys and girls can't talk? Why is it that boys and girls can't touch? Well, on one hand, you can say that from the perspective of the boy, okay, well, there are, of course, certain sins that he would be involved in, meaning that by him getting excited, various things can happen. He says, the truth of the matter is, all the sin is his. And the answer is no. He says, even another party, even somebody else who is bringing about that situation, she also is part of the sin. Intimate conversations between two people, a boy and a girl, which are not for the purpose of marriage, are not considered to be a positive thing. As what can lead from that is, even unknowingly on the part of anybody, is nevertheless is that, again, that boy should go ahead and get excited. And one thing ends up leading to another and results in, either on purpose or not on purpose, in sin. And not only that, it's something which the Zohar, meaning the emission of seed, is considered to be, when it says when it's not for the proper purpose of being in together with one's wife, that this is something which is considered to be one of the worst of all possible sins. And that situation, everybody ends up being guilty. Not just the person who this happens to, but the other person who's involved. And it's something to keep in mind when a person wants to understand how serious these matters are. He says that this is a question of biology and physicality. It's not even something which a person necessarily can do anything about. And therefore, there are strict limits placed on the interactions that can happen. That doesn't mean to say that in a business setting or so forth and so on, that again, there's a limit, but anything that becomes more intimate becomes an issue. Kol shekhen v'chol v'chomer, all the more so, even when a person thinks, what's the big deal, and a casual physical caressing and so forth and so on, which has no real serious intimate side to it, nevertheless, one thing leads to another. And therefore, the Torah places boundaries, and the Chachamim have placed boundaries, where we are to protect ourselves from getting ourselves into those sort of situations. So here also we understand the same thing. It's the chametz, the actual sin, and those that cause the sin, the two of them are in the same pot. Therefore, it's important to understand that it applies on both sides, and that from all of us, that we need to work with each other and realize and appreciate the limits that we have as human beings trying to become holy, that there is a limit as to what can be done before things get out of hand and then are beyond control. Sorry, the Mishra Shemitzvah, the various underpinnings of the Mishra are similar to what we said regarding all the other mitzvot of Pesach and the various laws that are explained in the Gemara Pesachim. It applies at all times. It applies to men and to females. If a person was to place within his home or his possession and so forth chametz, and he did this, you know, again, in other words, intentionally and there was an action involved in it, then he would receive Malkut. But if the situation was that before Pesach, he just left around his house something which was chametz, meaning he went ahead and he left a bunch of donuts sitting around his home and so forth. In this case, he doesn't receive the punishment from the Beit Din, from the courts, because of the fact that there's no action. One negative side to this, of course, is that punishments from the courts also create a situation where a person is then cleansed from his sins. So if a person was to not have that outlet, meaning if the fact that the courts couldn't be involved to go ahead and punish him, it means to say that he is left in a situation where he is actually in some ways in a much more dire situation from a spiritual perspective. So the point is that the person needs to be careful in order to be able to remove the potential from sin, because being negligent in the potential is in some ways, although maybe not in the punishment, but in some ways spiritually, much worse even than the sin itself. Why? Because when your person is sinning and he's actually doing an action, there's a Yetzirah. There's something driving him to do something wrong. There's some force within him which is convincing him that he should be doing something inappropriate. But here in this case, passively not preparing and not dealing with the issue, there's no force that's telling him anything here. He's just being negligent and neglecting what needs to get done. And of course this is like all of the mitzvot of this nature, meaning when you have a negative commandment which has no action, there is in fact no physical punishment from the courts, and that's been explained before in mitzvah number 9. The last class on the Shari Tshuva, for those that are interested, we dealt with this quite a bit. In the case of a negative commandment which does not have an action, and so forth and so on, and you may want to take a look into that, as like I said, there's much more on the issue. God willing, as each and every one of us is preparing, you know, hopefully in the coming now a month and a half away from Pesach, hopefully with all of what we discussed in terms of the preparations, we will with zeal make the preparations to remove chametz, to remove leavening, and with zeal apply ourselves to perform the mitzvot. And with all of that, God willing, see Mashiach Tzidkenu, b'mehra b'yameinu, amen. God willing, in the next class we'll begin the discussion of the storytelling, I mean the actual giving over and teaching of our children, the coming out of Egypt. Be well.